The Pro Tools Expert Podcast with Mike Thornton, Alan Salabag, and Dan Cooper.
Welcome to the Pro Tools Expert Podcast number 309. It's the 5th of March 2018. I'm Mike Thornton.
I'm Alan Salabank.
And I'm Dan Cooper.
So deals this month. This month's production expert has teamed up with Pro Sound Effects to offer a one-off exclusive bundle deal. The Cinema Sound Effects Bundle, combining three sound effects libraries by the Masters of Sound Effects, Anne Krober and Alan Splett, with an exclusive discount of over 30%. This bundle is totally exclusive to Production Expert, so get it before it's gone. A link in the podcast notes. And also, in modern vocal production, timing is everything.
Nice.
With that in mind, we are featuring this partner deal throughout March on the time alignment software Vocaline Project 3. Until the end of March 2018, Synchro Arts are offering a 30% discount on all new licenses and upgrades, making their Vocaline Project 3 available for the lowest price it's ever been in its 20-year history. Check out the link in the podcast notes, and you can also check out the rest of the deals from our partners in the partner deals section of the deals page.
Great. Okay, let's get on to some talking points, and these are sponsored by Universal Audio. Thanks, Fab.
Good morning, children. This is Fab DuPont. The Pro Tools Expert Podcast Talking Points are brought to you with the support of Universal Audio.
Looking to get that big analog console sound from your in-the-box mix? Well, if you buy and register any new UAD to DSP accelerator between January the 1st and March the 31st, 2018, you will get the world's most authentic Neve API SSL and UA console emulation plugins for Mac and Windows with a value of up to $1,196 absolutely free as part of the UAD Classic Consoles plugin promotion. Click the link in the podcast notes for more info.
Okay, so first talking point is an article entitled Five Greedy Plugins That Use A Lot Of My CPU Power. Now, Dan, the my in this title is yours.
Yes.
So what triggered you to write this article?
Oh, I don't know. What triggers my computer to crash?
plugins, okay. Yeah,
some plugins, yeah, exactly. This is just sort of getting a list going, get some guys to sort of like share their the plugins they use that, you know, topple their systems. I usually find it's just that one plugin towards the end of a mix that makes computer go no. You know what I mean? You know, think just one more stroke of my brush and you've had enough. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. But these are really good plugins. I use these plugins all the time. Adaptive Verb, Synaptic, brilliant plugin. But you do see the steam coming out of the Mac when you put an instance of that on. Same with Abbey Road Plates. I mean, that is a beautiful, beautiful sounding reverb. It's so good. I wish I could use it more often, but I do use it sparingly. Again, the little hamster in there gets its legs get tired quite quickly. The the Nuclear Bomb plugin is Elevate by Newfangled Audio. That thing is monstrous. I'm surprised I can run an instance of it at all. But it sounds brilliant. Eli really likes that. That was his find of the year last year, if I remember correct. Mike, I'm sure, and Alan, you guys being post, what plugins crash your systems? What ones do you sort of, you know, have to squint at when you load it up, thinking, is this going to, you know, push my system a bit hard?
Well, I mean, the live noise reduction ones are always a bit hungry, shall we say. But you sort of, I only tend to notice that when the session's loading up. You get, you know, it's opening tracks and what have you, and then it gets to the dialogue tracks, say, which have got the noise reduction on, and it's right down, and then it speeds back up again. But then once it's all been allocated, it's all fine. And the thing about the noise reduction plugins is, I think, is the visual interface on them doesn't need to be that complex, really. For the live ones, certainly not. For the offline processing ones, you need as much detail as you can get to hack around in the sound. But if you're, say, using the RX Dialog denoiser, then really, if you've got it set to auto, then you don't really need to reference it at all. You just need to know it's there and switched into circuit. And it's that visual interface thing. I mean, Insight has always been a huge hog, but not of CPU. Which brings me to my point, which is you can have the most powerful CPU ever. I mean, you can have, twin 12-core Xeons in your Mac Pro, and you can have 64 gigabytes of RAM. But if you've still got the 512 megabyte AMD 6450 Jack graphics card, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
That's the bottleneck. You see?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because people are talking about in the comments, they're talking about hardware acceleration, and they miss the most common one that makes the biggest difference, which is the graphics card.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely the case. And so, and that's the thing. I mean, I've never had, as a Windows user, huge problems with Waves. But since they came off of iLock, and they went through Waves Central, I think it is, isn't it? Yeah. That's when things have been getting a little bit tweakier. They've been a bit sort of, you're starting to see a lot more reports of, you can't have multiple windows with Waves plugins. They just freeze out and lock the system up and you try and open them, which was something I never saw. But I've always had a decent graphics card in the system. It's always been something that alleviates the main CPU and the RAM from excessive load. So I think that's the trick with that. I think going to hardware acceleration, audio DSP-wise as well, again, we're looking at the main option, which is HDX, is how many years old now, Mike? I can't remember now how many.
It's seven.
Yeah, that's pensionable age in computer
I haven't got to HDX in the history of Pro Tools. I'm still back in... I'm just about to arrive at 7.4 in the various articles that I'm writing.
Oh, that was the one that really made the difference of post as well.
Yes, 7.4. Indeed.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I had it must be because my 2000, yes, it was 2012 when I bought HDX, and I pretty well got serial number one. So yeah,
I got two.
but of course, that's another story. The lack of DSP plugins, but yeah, the point you're making, I suspect, is that the technology and the chipsets on the HDX cards are not exactly in their first bloom of youth, or whatever the phrase is.
I think I've been through like three or four iPhones in the time I've had an HDX card. Just to put that out there, something to think about.
But I think one of the things that, looking through the comments, we got somebody sort of talking about overclocking processors. And then, Alan, the other thing I wanted to be interested in your opinion is this business about turning off hyperthreading. And I've done a little bit of reading into it, and I'm still remain to be convinced about this issue. You go on the DUC and you see various comments saying, oh, yeah, it's the best thing ever, and other people are saying, no, it didn't work for me. And I just wonder what your view is, because obviously the hyperthreading issue is not a Mac versus Windows debate. It's an issue for both platforms.
Well, I think the way they implement hyperthreading, the way I understand it, is there is so much headroom on the processors that you can basically double time them. So all the processors have got so much processing headroom, they could go so much faster than every other part of the processing chain. Because if you remember, you have to get it off your hard drive or storage, through Pro Tools, into RAM, out of RAM, into the processor, back out of the processor into RAM, into your hard, into your DSP and back again. It's got to go through a lot of corridors, shall we say. And if those corridors aren't as wide as what the CPU can process, then there's spare bandwidth in the way. And that's what that's how they can do hyperthreading. So they can actually turn it into, rather than a parallel process, a serial process so fast that it appears to be a parallel process. So I don't see any advantage personally in disabling hyperthreading, because to me, it's just not taking advantage of that. With older operating systems, it made more sense because you were forcing the allocation of your plugins and such to be, I suppose, more efficient, and less chances of processes being split across cores. But since dynamic allocation in Pro Tools 11 onwards properly, with a 64-bit operating system, this is not something I've really come up across at all. Trying to run low sample buffer rates on low speed audio interface connections, however, has a massive impact. Massive impact at all. So the difference between my RME, which has got great performance on USB 2, try turning down the sample buffer on it, and it's a complete nightmare. However, with the Presonus Quantums that I had a little while back, right down to 32 samples, no issue, no noticeable impact on the mix load. So it really pays to make sure that all your corridors are as wide and slip-proof as possible, for want of a better analogy.
But I seem to remember, and might have got my stories mixed up, but I seem to remember that some of the debate about hyperthreading and the reason to turn it off is because of Avid's implementation of hyperthreading not perhaps being as good as it could be. Is that something you've heard about?
I think that was possibly the case back in sort of pre-64-bit days.
Yeah.
Certainly, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about sort of what Pro Tools reports as your system usage and what your actual system usage is. So Pro Tools is referring back to you how much of the system Pro Tools is using. It's ignoring other stuff, but it can, on the overall... Well, actually, let's go wind back a bit on that. On your system usage meters, you've got all the cores broken down individually, but you've got a total at the top.
Yeah.
Now, the total one, as far as my experience goes, seems to measure the total drain on the CPU. Mm-hmm. So at times when I've been trying to do stress tests or video capture of stress tests and stuff like that, running the screen cap software is the straw that breaks the camel's back. It all runs fine until you start hitting record on the screen capture.
And record and then the thing,
yeah.
I forgot to mention that as well.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that never, ever fails to give me the buffer error on my MacBook is having more than two tabs of Chrome open at the same time. Chrome is the biggest CPU hog.
Absolutely.
And GPU hog as well, because it uses graphics acceleration as well.
Yeah.
So if you've got a page like Facebook open, or even, dare I say it, ProToolsExpert.com, that just the animations and the video previews and such like that can easily completely overload your host system to the point where Pro Tools just doesn't get a look in. And the fan kicks in and it's into Concord mode until you restart it and switch off Chrome and switch off everything apart from Pro Tools. And then it's happy motoring again. But
no, it's very good.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, to pick up your point, Dan, I think for me, certainly in post, and I suspect Alan, we tend not to use the sorts of plugins that can be CPU hungry. I mean, again, as a sweeping statement, shall we say, in post, we probably tend to use a lot less plugins than our music colleagues.
Probably Carlos VI style stuff.
Yeah. But you probably run very large sessions.
Yes, and track count and
yeah. Well, having said that, also Stutter Edit. That one is a killer. I will say that. But that's because it is live sampling and looping stuff, you know, on the fly.
Yeah.
As well, it's basically a VI in its own right. But that's the only sort of more post-production one, and it's a crossover plugin anyway. So, I totally agree with you, Michael. We tend to use batches of quite high consumption plugins, but not we don't have them on every channel, do we?
No. And most channels can have very few plugins, or just a bit of EQ. The EQ3 or the EQ7 plugin, and maybe a compressor, but not a huge amount. So that a lot of what we do, and of course then reverb, certainly for me, I'm not using convolution reverbs, which can be pretty CPU intensive. I much prefer to use algorithmic reverbs. Again, they are much less hungry on the old CPU usage. You have been in the notes. You have been commenting on plugins that you find heavy. Continue to let us know, so that the community can get a sense of some of the plugins that do take up a bit of CPU usage. But I would like to finish this section by revisiting Alan's point right at the beginning, and that is a graphics card. A lot of these so-called CPU-hungry plugins are hungry because they're doing a lot of graphics-orientated stuff. Now we want real-time spectrum analysis going on EQs and all the rest of it. That uses an awful lot more graphics power. And I certainly noticed a huge difference when I took my stock graphics card out of my Mac Pro cheese grater and put in a much more powerful Mac-friendly graphics card. Mm. A lot of my issues disappeared with doing that. So that is certainly something to consider before you start blaming lots of plugins for hogging your CPU. Just make sure that your computer has the oomph to handle all this graphics processing. Okay, let's move on to the second talking point. And that was a roundup that Julian put together on hardware speaker correction systems. Follows on from an article that I put together a couple of weeks ago on monitor controllers. And of course, not unsurprisingly, there's quite a bit of sort of crossover between these two areas, because quite a few of the units that we look at and have looked at do both. Obviously, personally, I've got the Dirac Mini DSP hardware unit. So it was a piece of software that I ran on my Mac, which did the analysis using a measurement mic to analyze various points in the room, coming up with a curve, and then loading that curve into the DSP chip inside the 1U rack mount unit, and then basically forget it. Although it's interesting, I was reading somewhere that one person was recommending that you don't just forget it, because things do change, and it's worth reanalyzing every so often to make sure that things haven't changed. So that's certainly on my to-do list. Alan, if I can turn to you, what's your sort of thoughts and views and experience on these sort of hardware speaker correction systems? And we do stress we're talking speaker correction, not room correction.
Not room calibration.
Oh, let's not get into this debate.
No.
Yes.
No, we're not getting into that debate. Absolutely not.
Well, it's really difficult with multi-channel.
Yes.
I mean, you know, so Sonarworks, they Point Blank refuse to do a multi-channel version. I've been talking to them since version 2, and no, they say, no, we're not going to touch that with anybody else's barge pole. There's just too much complication involved with it for a, yeah, for a software platform version to try and cope with. In terms of the hardware, I mean, from day zero for me, I've been working with speaker correction hardware, which is the Dolby Cinema processors.
Mm.
And so they originally had very primitive EQ correction there. But, and it wasn't too, I think it's important to stress that the Dolby correction hardware is not there to correct anything. It's there to align your system to a universal standard.
Yes.
And that's the difference between using it, using a speaker correction system for music and for post. Because, I mean, the amount of times I've had composers walk into the dubbing theatre, take one listen to the cue that you're playing and go, what the hell have you done to it? And you go, you point at the channel and say, look, it's completely flat and it's unity. Hmm. I'm just feeding it through a cinema monitoring system.
Yes.
Which has horns behind a perforated screen. It's never going to sound like it did off your B&W three ways in the Abbey Road penthouse.
Hmm.
But this is the way it's going to sound like in real life. And it's important to sort of to clarify the difference between it, because I think sometimes some room correction, speaker correction systems, they try and do too much. So, for instance, the Trinoff system tries to correct phase inconsistencies in the surround sound.
And height. Now,
that's the thing. So that's the problem, because it's trying to do too much. If you've got speakers dead behind you running at the same time as speakers dead in front of you running the same signal, they're going to be out of phase with each other. It stands to reason. It's basic physics. So there's no point trying to correct those sort of things, because you're starting to correct out the stuff that gives the surround sound effect. And I was probably the only person in that room with the Trinov demonstration that didn't like it. I thought it really mullered things for me. And I haven't heard the DAD one, which I'm really excited about, and I'd love to hear that soon. But for me, the best one I've ever heard is the Genelec one. And that's only because it knows what speakers it's working with and works with a degree of intelligence around the characteristics of the speakers it's correcting. So I think that's the perfect combination, because I think where things like the Trinov fall down is they have no idea what they're correcting. So they don't know whether the speaker's rear-ported, front-ported, two-way, three-way, four-way. It's got no idea. So it's trying to get an ideal performance out of a very much non-ideal setup.
It's vague, isn't it? I see what you're on about. It does stand to reason, doesn't it? Speaker correction, software, hardware, whatever. If it doesn't know what the speakers are and what its characteristics are, of course you're going to come into problems. I had problems with mine when I moved into this new studio. I wrote an article about it. My Adams P22As were just sounded really honky, and that was with sonar work. So I was scratching my head going, what the hell's going on here? And realised I couldn't, well, I lost a load of headroom out of the monitors, because there was some, there must have been quite a bad mode in here. And I had to put a subwoofer in just to put a bit more energy into my monitoring, which has fixed the problem. There's lots of variables. Speaker correction software, calibration software, we don't call it, does help. It depends on so many other factors. The Trinoff thing, I liked the idea of it being in a box, DSP. I know James likes that very, very much, because he just turns it on and forgets about it. And, you know, his studio is very, very complicated. I know he just appreciates having a very simple box he turns on and forgets about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Sonarworks. I've been using that now for about, coming up to 3 years. And I do kind of wish that it was in a monitor controller. That would be brilliant if they partnered up with someone.
Use the software to, like the my Dirac one, use the software to analyze it, and then stuff the the results of the analysis into a black box and then leave it alone.
Imagine if it was something refreshing. Like,
I'm just refreshing myself with your review, Mike, actually, the Dirac, and it does seem to me to be the perfect, well, not the perfect solution, because there isn't one, but I think it seems to be the most sensible one, in my
certainly
opinion.
Certainly for up to 7.1, because it's an 8-channel device, although I do understand that there are moves afoot to increase the channel I.O. count. Because obviously, again, as you say, as soon as we're into Dolby Atmos and all the rest of it, you've got an awful lot of channels. I was talking to Jan from DAD at BVE last week, and certainly their speaker correction card, in essence, is a whole load of filters which you can configure. So you use something like the smart software to basically measure your room, measure your speakers, find out what the issues are, and then take that data and build yourself a matching curve. There is delay in there, but there isn't phase adjustment. But there is delay. And again, I mean, one of the reasons we need delay in a post system is that the speakers aren't necessarily all the same distance from the person who is mixing. So having that option to effectively time align them so that the sound does arrive at my ears from all the speakers all at the same time is a key part of it. So there is delay. There are these 1,024 filters. It can handle up to 128 channels, so I think we can safely say that's pretty Dolby Atmos friendly. So yes, that is coming along very nicely, and we are optimistic, but we don't have information specifically, but we are optimistic that Avid will license a version of the DAD speaker correction card for their MTRX. But at the moment, if you're
sounds
in...
Sounds sensible.
Yeah. But at the moment, it's only... the speaker correction card is only available to fit in the DAD models, so the AX32.
I mean, you were saying about set and forget as well.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the day where you used to, you know, but you still get a Dolby license for if you're doing a feature film for a Dolby release, but you used to get... at the beginning and at the end mastering point of the film mix, the Dolby engineer would come in and what we call squeak the room.
Yes.
So run the analysis through it, check everything's still up to spec and it's still where you go. And I mean, not a single time was it absolutely bang on every time.
No.
And the only time that stopped happening was when we went to a... DP750 cinema processor, they call it, which had the digital EQs and everything, rather than something like the old CP65, which had just analog EQs on breadboards, which you had to, you know, pop out into extenders to adjust. Yeah. So just the sheer physical action of popping a breadboard card out onto an extender probably changes his performance anyway.
Definitely.
there was only so close you could get roomed into a line anyway, and there was a certain amount of, you know, the Dolby guys would, you know, run the tests through the system, look at it on their Abacus analyzers, and then they would just stop and run some material through it. And they'd either go, yeah, that sounds about right, or... nah. Okay. The Abacus is telling me fibs. So then just revert to lining it up by ear and using experience. So it's interesting, as you said, Dan, there's certain things that can really fool these systems. I mean, on my home hi-fi system, which has got the Audacy auto-alignment stuff, I found in my old house, because it was sort of semi-open plan to the kitchen, if the boiler was on, it was adding a certain level of LF to just the room tone. And that completely fooled the Audacy, and it took all the bass out of my monitoring. So, switch the heating off, came out sounding great. Switch the heating on, came out sounding tinny as hell. So
I think
really
I can win this. I can win. I spent 6 months working in a conservatory.
Yeah,
definitely.
And sonar works wouldn't even work. It didn't work. Glass walls, glass ceiling, glass patio doors at the back of it. It had no chance. I even contacted them and said, yeah, it's not working. I went, they couldn't really help, but I said, look, don't worry about it. It's only temporary. It's, I'm asking too much of it, I know.
I can imagine. Yeah. Did they have a stock's error message, which is, what the hell are you playing at?
Yes, too many reflections. One thing I would say, though, if I bought a new set of monitors, I would probably have to remeasure my room weekly for some time until my speakers sort of burnt in, settled, and become less sort of tight. You know what I mean?
With
headphones, you get that. You get a new set of headphones, and over a short amount of time, they settle a little bit more.
Yeah, they burn in. I remember with new speakers, you would often just run them and just get everything settled in.
Yeah, it's... Mind you, the only ones I've heard that have just been starting out of the box again have been the Genelec ones, which are mentioned in the article in the comment section. The people who commented about it are just saying, and the only downside of it is, you know, having to work out how to raise $8,000 for a pair. So, but they do sound excellent. They're just utterly incredible.
That really does seem to make sense to actually do the analysis in the speaker, knowing what the speaker is, it just makes a lot more sense to have that as a match pair, as it were.
It's another piece of the puzzle, isn't it? You know,
I mean, it's like on Sonarworks, the headphone calibration, haven't they? They've got various different presets for the brands of headphones, haven't they?
They've got different, well, it's one step further than that. You can buy. I've got them. I'm wearing them now. I've got several sets of KRK 8400s, and they've got an average calibration file. So it's the curve that they believe is the average strengths and weaknesses, la la, to give you a flat frequency response in your KRK 8400s. That's all good. Or they can send you a set, or they'll sell you a set that's individually calibrated. So they stick that on top of their. I don't know how they do it. I reckon it's one of those mannequin microphone doll things. Yeah. I don't know. And they measure to exactly that set of headphones, and they put a little label on it and say, these headphones to that file. And there is a difference. There is a difference. There is actually a review I did of this a little while ago, a couple of years ago. And to be honest, you'd have to be listening with these exact headphones to hear it. And that makes a lot of sense. Or you can send them your headphones. Send them in the post, and
we've got too much wax.
I'm tempted just to find the shittest set of headphones, you know, like from the 80s, the old Walkman ones, and just send them, see if they like take me seriously.
A pair of those yellow Sony ones that everyone used to use.
Yeah, and one of them's, you know, one side's
wish
blown
or they
something
had washing
and
up sponges on them.
Yeah, that's it. And I'll send them that, and at the bottom I say, from Dan at Pro Tools Expert, be your best.
Okay, let's move along. There's no community feedback this week, so the questions on Pro Tools Expert podcast are sponsored by RSPE Audio Solutions.
The Pro Tools Expert community feedback is brought to you with the kind support of RSPE Audio Solutions. Great people and great prices.
Well, there's finally an affordable way to get yourself some PMC studio monitors, as in another way, unlike me who bought secondhand ones and is loving them. There are now some affordable new ones called the Result 6, and both James and Dan heard these in the PMC listening room at NAMM, and I think it's safe to say you quite like them.
The red wine was quite nice as well.
And
they were really nice.
PMC tell us that these are the result, pun intended, of 26 years of painstaking development, bringing us the PMC patented technology and sound at an affordable price. So if you're interested, and especially if you're in the west coast of America, then do check out our friends at RSPE on their website. We'll put a link in the podcast notes to help you find more about the Result 6s from PMC. Okay, so we've got one question from Lucas Zimmerman. He said, I was wondering if you guys had run any tests on the new iMac Pro. I was thinking I need to upgrade my studio. I'm struggling all the time with using software synths and big sessions on my system, which is an HD native running on OS X 10.12 on a quad-core all SSD machine. He says, although it's a cool and very stable system for recording and basic mixing, as soon as I'm starting to use synths and stuff, I have to freeze everything, so track freeze, if I want to use more than three or four synths at the same time. So I'd be interested in how much faster or more power the 12-core has compared to the 8-core. Now we're talking iMac Pros here. In some respects, I think some of this actually comes back to the issues that we were talking about in terms of hungry plugins. Alan, you've got some thoughts here.
Stand well back. Stand well back, everyone.
They're not popular.
Run.
The iMac Pro to me is the complete antithesis of common sense for audio computing. There you go. I've said it. There's the bomb.
What's the reason?
You can't, because you have got your processor, your RAM, any hard drives you will need, all your peripherals right in front of you. So any noise that comes from it, it's like your laptop. Any noise, you can't isolate it. You can't repair it. It's not officially user repairable or upgradable. It's, great for colleges where they have rows and rows and rows of people learning Final Cut or After Effects. Because, yes, it is quite a good visual processor.
It's a good graphics
machine. It's a great graphics churner, yeah. But the thing is, noise, and in those sort of environments, thinking ahead doesn't matter. Because, they get regular CapEx and they get an educational discount from Apple as well. If we're talking common sense, this is the same company that has just built in their new building in the UK a sort of concentric design with lots of layers of glass walls against the advice of health and safety. And they've now had three injuries of people just walking straight into them. So this is the sort of logic that I come to expect from Apple. And I'm sorry, this is a personal opinion about this, and so you feel free to completely ignore it. I think really, if you're jumping from, is it a cheese grater? Was it the original?
Yes, a quad-core cheese grater.
Yeah, you're really going to miss the ability to pop the side off of it, especially taken that up to four SSDs now. You're not going to be able to fit any of those SSDs into your iMac Pro. You're going to have to buy another £400 expansion chassis. You're going to have to buy a whole bunch more £30 at a time Thunderbolt cables.
Because
if you just want them on the desktop.
Yeah, and if you're running an HD native on a quad core, then that probably means that will mean that you've got an HD native card. So you've either got to buy an expansion chassis for the iMac Pro or trade your HD native card in for the Avid HD native Thunderbolt box.
If you ever want to upgrade your monitor, you're stuck.
Yes.
Or if your monitor goes wrong or whatever. I mean, in the last couple of years, last 5 years, I've got through two sets of monitors. So
I would say where Lucas, you are now with your current computer, if you went for the iMac Pro, you wouldn't be taking a step forward. you'd be taking a step sideways, yeah. I think, and you would be stuck to move forward. You'd be where you are now in probably a year or two, going, ah, crap, I'm a bit stuck. I wish I didn't spend all that money on this system. Now, the iMac Pro, I think it's for Final Cut guys, freelancers. Alan's right, education.
It's also, even the base model is pretty expensive.
Oh, it's $5,000.
Yeah.
Yes, but $5,000 before you put any toys on it.
That's a major gulp time, you know.
That's more than a Mac Pro, mid-range sort of Mac Pro sort of territory. I would just don't consider it. For what you need, it's not really going to be the thing. Go on.
I would make two suggestions, depending on your capabilities in the sort of DIY route. We posted a while back an article where someone took a quad-core Mac Pro cheese grater and basically put new processor chips in it, which would give you a lot more processor power. If you've also got an old Mac Pro, then put, as we talked about in the first talking point, put in a decent graphics card. And I think those combat, because you've already done the obvious thing, which is SSDs, and that if you were capable of doing that it's not even surgery, it's just dismantling your Mac Pro, taking the heat sinks off the processor module, taking out the old processors, cleaning up all the old silicon grease, putting the new ones in back again, then you are going to, for bang for buck, you are going to get a really powerful machine, because what is in fact really a powerful processor or set of processors for a cheese grater are second-hand processors. You can buy them on eBay. Again, the article and the video that we referred to points out that you can get these second-hand processors. Because, of course, the most current versions of processors are not Mac Pro friendly. So for not a huge amount of money, if you're comfortable and competent and feel comfortable in doing that DIY work, you could get a really, really powerful machine. So by upgrading the processor chips and putting in a new graphics card, you would probably get a machine that was going to be going to certainly buy you a significant amount of time. It may be that at the point at which we get the new modular Mac Pro machine, that might be something worth considering. But I think you need an interim. So that's one option. Put new processors in your existing quad-core machine. And the other option, if you don't feel comfortable about doing that DIY job, I would look at a second-hand Mac Pro trash can. Again, if you want to stay in the Mac world. Obviously, as we've seen with various articles that Alan's put up, and your Plan B machine still blows me away, that for £850, you've got an incredibly powerful machine. When you consider what money I'm having to spend on, we spend on the on Macs, that really is...
I don't want to be too down on Mac, really, because I don't want to have that rep as being the grumpy old guy in the corner who hates Macintoshes. It's not true. I have previously specified Macs, but, that's back in the cheese grater days and what have you. But I still think, as you say, find a refurbished Mac Pro 6.1. And get one that's as stacked up as possible.
Yeah.
Because they're going for $2,500-$3,000.
Yeah.
Which is still a hell of a lot more value.
Yeah. I think if you bought a used 6.1 Mac Pro, you still will be spending a bit of money, but it'll tide you over to the next.
It's a far wiser investment.
That is a step forward. That's your next step to the next step. You're not losing money that way, I don't think. If you go iMac route, as Alan has sort of alluding to, you're stuck. Dead end. That is what it is. That's a hand-me-down when you're finished with it. It's not going to benefit you when you need to grow, you know.
Well, I had this communication from an old friend of mine who's a sound editor and sound designer, and he needs to be able to run, you know, VI samplers and such like that in his sound design. So his old cheese grater is getting very much long in the tooth. He's not particularly technically minded, and so he flagged me up a few options, a pimped cheese grater and various refurbished Mac Pro 6.1s and the other way. And my advice to him was go for the 6.1, because if you go for the pimped cheese grater, you're never ever going to have Thunderbolt.
Correct.
He came back and said, "Oh yeah, but I don't have any plans to use Thunderbolt." And I say, "Really?
One day?
No, you will.
Yeah. It's not if, you it's will. When. I'm actually quite interested, Lucas, to know what VIs you're using, what synths you're using. To have three or four topple your machine is it baffles me a little bit. What are you using? Because I can use quite a lot of synths and VIs on my system. You know, I can run Superior Drummer 3, loads of UVI stuff, Native Instruments stuff, because I'm a VI user, first and foremost. Loads of plugins natively, and I don't really have that many problems on my old machine. Obviously, you know, there were those plugins I mentioned earlier, the greedy ones. But three or four synths, that sounds possibly like there could be a little software problem going on.
But with only a quad core, I don't think that's an unreasonable outcome for a quad core machine.
I've got a quad core, 2x2.4 quad core.
Okay, very nice.
32 gigs of RAM. All SSDs as well.
That displays a 16 CPUs on, doesn't it? On your
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's more equivalent to my Plan B machine, which is a quad core hyper-threaded, or my laptop, my MacBook Pro, which is, again, it's an i7 quad-core. And, yeah, I mean, the main time I experience problems with the MacBook Pro is when there's other stuff running at the same time, which is weighing it down.
As you just said earlier, I would look at the synths that you're using. Make sure that you've got them properly set up. Some synths have preferences where you can make it run in light mode. There are some synths that go, you know, full fat, everything's running, it's, you know, the highest oversampled monster in the world, and then it'll crash the system. But you know, dial it back in the settings and it goes, we're running in light mode, and you're getting 80% of the effects, and you can barely hear it, but it saves on your resources. I'm not going to name any off the top of my head, since it do that, it'd be nice to know what you're using. Maybe let us know in the podcast notes when you hear this, and we'll see if we can help.
Good. Okay, let's move along to our next section.
The Pro Tools Expert podcast is created using Source Connect Now from Source Elements. Register now for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
If you've ever tried to do interviews over the internet with apps like Skype, you'll know how hit and miss the audio quality and connection can be, and even on a good day, it isn't really good enough for a long-form interview. We now use Source Connect Now, which offers ISDN equivalent quality audio using a Chrome browser with no software to install. To get your free account, follow the link in the podcast notes.
Okay, so find of the week. Dan, what's yours?
Mine, IK Multimedia 1 mastering processor. Now, this came out when T-Rex was updated recently, T-Rex 5, and this was one of the new plugins within that bundle. And I didn't really pay it much attention, if I'm honest. I've got T-Rex 5, and I was just fiddling around the other day mixing some drums. I thought, go on in, let's throw this on the submix to see what it can do. Oh, my word, it's brilliant. I really wish I didn't call these things mastering processors. Why not just call it like brilliant dynamics processor? Do you know what I mean? Because it was the thing, mastering processor, that kind of put me off it. But wow, this thing is really, really good. So, you know, the controls are kind of describe so a child could understand what these things do, like focus, body, push, width, volume, analog, transients. Now, it's not nerdy, which is great for thick people like me who just wants to go, I want more oomph. Oh, there's an oomph thing. You know, it's great. Really, really good. I will put a video together because, yeah, I was so surprised at this. And to be honest, there are quite a few IK multimedia plugins that do make me go, oh, wow, that's really quite good. I didn't think it would be. Yeah, and it's a bargain, I think, at $99, I believe, something like that. So, yeah, I'll put a little video together with this in the next coming weeks and share my excitement.
Good. Alan, what's your find of the week?
Well, there was a magnificent documentary, as there quite often is, on BBC Four over the weekend.
Yes, definitely.
Tones, Drones and Arpeggios, The Magic of Minimalism in Music. For an audio nerd and for a bit of an arty nerd as well, absolute bliss. I mean, it's just... It's another one of these BBC documentaries where you can think you know a lot about a subject and they will tell you about it and there's still stuff that you discover and you go, I never knew that. Oh, that makes complete sense. And it is, again, another magnificent documentary. And there's one section of it. Jarvis Cocker is talking about walking through an installation by one of the main... cornerstones of minimalism in music, and basically he had taken the notes of a drone and instead of feeding them all through the same set of speakers mixed together, he'd set like an Atmos style monitoring rig, so suspended speakers behind you and around you around the room, and put each individual note out through each individual speaker.
Interesting.
So as you walk through the room, you get an experience that is absolutely unique to you. And that's mind-blowing because there's no way it can be captured. There's no way it can be described. It's an experience that's absolutely unique and never repeatable because you can never be in exactly the same position with your head facing in exactly the same way or have the same exactly the same shape ears as anybody else. And you're walking through these interference patterns going on between the loudspeakers. And it's a complete nerdgasm, generally. Just mind-blowing concept. And I think that I would absolutely love to experience that as well.
So hardware speaker correction then would be wasted on that.
Oh, yeah. That would somewhat...
And it's funny,
it's one of the first times I've heard Jarvis Cocker talking about something and thought, you're speaking complete sense, actually. But yeah, again, lots of revelations. Yet another magnificent example of BBC programme making at its best. Definitely.
Mike, how about you?
Well, mine is a video which I posted on the site on Saturday entitled Inside Pinewood's Foley Studio. Now, there's been a number of videos out and about sort of inside sort of Foley type and videos, and some of them have sort of left me slightly shortchanged, I think. This one is completely different. I think it's... I was completely blown away. It actually comes from the BAFTA Guru Library, a whole raft, a whole YouTube channel, mainly of practitioners being interviewed and talking about what they do and how they do it. But there are a small handful of videos, and this was one of them, where you've actually got practitioners demonstrating what they do and how they do it. And this one, the team led by Pete Burgess, and just phenomenal. Again, it would just reminding me that we so often talk about Foley artists, and you think, yeah, in this geeky tech world, artist, absolutely. And actually to see them manipulate objects and listen to the sound that they get out of it. It was mind-blowing, very educational, and come away from that with huge respect.
I've always said that there is as much artistry and acting in a Foley artist's
yes.
performance, and it is, it's absolutely performance, and it's as unique as any take of any actor.
Yeah.
Because they're adding to the character of the actor. They're building it from scratch in a lot of cases. And it requires that artistry. It requires that ingenuity, lateral thinking, you know, thinking outside the box, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And this is why, I mean, I've always been the case. You can't replace a Foley artist with a sample library. It's
no.
just, you can see for yourself when you watch the film, there's so much that goes into it.
And the magic is when you can't even hear that a Foley artist has been doing all
oh,
that
no,
stuff
absolutely.
As well. Do you
yeah.
know what I mean? It's smoke and mirrors. That's the mark of a very
When you
skilled...
believe it's real life, then...
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Exactly.
Definitely.
No, I mean, for me, having come from a radio background where we have spot effect artists, so effectively the Foley artist adding the sound effects in the same space as the actors are acting... is again fun. I've been both on the mixing and recording end of that, as well as the being said Foley artist, and just being able to work with the actors. So as they're talking, what you are doing is absolutely in harmony with their acting. You're providing all the extra bits, turning the water on and the taps, you know, turning the cooker on. Getting into bed, all the rest of it, all. So again, a very similar set of skills to the film and more and more TV Foley artists. So if you haven't watched it, even if you're not into post, I strongly recommend you take a look at the article called "Case Study Inside the Pinewood Foley Studio." So on that recommendation, it's time to pull up stumps. So it's good night from me.
It's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Good night.